I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Timothy Taylor joins me now. He's just written a charming new book, Foodville, Biting Dispatches from a Food-Obsessed City. It's a neat book with Mr. Taylor's observations on food, lovingly recalled, as well as his own experimenting with it and his travels for it. You also have a view onto the food culture here in Vancouver, something that we're all participants in, varying degrees of insufferability, whether we indulge in food porn or have to go to every new place because being at a new place is the hip and happening thing to do. There's a lot of hype around food, and we're increasingly hyped up about it. I'll ask Mr. Taylor why, just what a foodie is, as well as how this book came about. It's one of the first books published by Nonvella, which takes works of nonfiction in the area of 5,000 to 20,000 words and publishes them through a scheme that's sympathetic to the writer. I'll ask Mr. Taylor about his experiences with food. He shares a lot of them in this book. Timothy Taylor is a noted author and journalist. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Creative Writing at the University of British Columbia. He's written two books of nonfiction and four works of fiction, including Stanley Park and the Blue Light Project. The website for more is at timothytaylor.ca. Nonvella can be found at nonvella.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Timothy Taylor. Mr. Taylor, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The word foodie is thrown around quite a bit on the internet and the sort, and I guess we all are to a certain extent, but how do you define what a foodie is?
It's tricky, you know, because for years I really sort of bristled at the suggestion that I was a foodie. I didn't like the word, I guess I still don't. To me, it implies a kind of sort of frantic consumer behavior where, just as you described in your intro, where sort of people rushing around to do the newest thing, to have the newest expertise, to be the most refined connoisseur. And as I have discussed in various different articles I've written over the years about connoisseurship and the food world, you know, there is a kind of competitive restlessness to all that I don't feel in my own life. I don't feel that way about food. When I like to eat in a very relaxed way, my home cuisine is a sort of weird product of my hybrid family background, and I like it that way. And in restaurants, the red flag for me is pretension. You know, when you go into a restaurant and you get the feeling like they're trying to be something for the public and trying to be the coolest, newest thing, it's just an instant turn off for me. So turn off, I should clarify. So you know, so in that, to that extent, I don't consider myself a foodie. But at the same time, listen, I got to admit, you know, I've done things like structure holidays around looking for certain kinds of cheeses in rural France, and you know, I've done that stuff. So hey, I'm probably guilty, but that's my long answer.
Yeah, I guess this hyper consciousness around food. I guess social media enables it. And do you think being health conscious has inspired it? I mean, a lot of us, well, not me, but a lot of people want to know where their food comes from, how it's grown, how it comes about, and what it does to us. And has that, do you think, inspired us to be interested in food as we have been in the last 15, 20 years, say?
I think the relationship between those two things is crucial. I don't think that health consciousness inspired the food phenomenon, the food consumer phenomenon, as much as it justified it. And so food is one of those sweet spot consumer items where the consumption makes the consumer feel good. And that is the case when you structure a cuisine around, you know, the sort of virtue of locality, for example. People consume the food and they feel really good about themselves. They feel like they're doing something meaningful and good for the environment and good for their bodies. So I think it's a real happy marriage, the health consciousness and what a lot of foodie values are nowadays. But it's more a question, I think, of that being sort of a happy coincidence than one causing the other.
And the social media aspect of it, I mean, people have, as I said in the introduction, have been quite insufferable. I mean, there's a lot of dreck online in terms of food criticism, say, from bloggers and the sort. I mean, there's some good, but I mean, I don't mind the photographs of food porn. I don't mind that.
Well, there's a whole storm of stuff online, right? I mean, that's been one really interesting, you know, development over the course of the past 10 years, I'd say, which is the movement of criticism from this kind of notionally objective realm where somebody sat down and said, you know, I've eaten in many restaurants and this one ranks, you know, third, and instead moved into this sort of, you know, free-flowing, ongoing conversation where people just sort of announce what they're eating, and that is sort of, it's the criticism has sort of become part of the consumable product now.
And do you find that the people that we see online and the sort, in terms of because there are a lot of food bloggers in Vancouver, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Do you find that they're savvy eaters?
I don't read a lot of them, I'll be honest with you. Yeah. I don't. See, that when in the past when I've objected that I'm not a foodie, what I'm really saying is that I'm not a big food consumer in that conventional sense. I don't. I mean, I do go to restaurants, but mostly in my role as a critic for Vancouver Magazine. You know, I mean, otherwise I just go to comfortable places that I know. I'm not at all the kind of person who hears about a new restaurant and seeks it out right away. And likewise, when it comes to online food consumables and like blogs and pictures and stuff, I don't really make a lot of use of them.
Yeah, a friend of mine was complaining about a couple of local bloggers who are saying that. Well, one complained about a tapas place because they found that the portions were too small.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, and then there was another one who complained about the risotto at some place because there wasn't they didn't think there was enough cream in it.
Okay.
So,
well, you know, this is the thing with connoisseurship, which is I find pretty fascinating. You know, because connoisseurship is really inspired by observing other people. You wouldn't know to think that the risotto was lacking in creaminess unless you had heard or read somewhere that it should be extra creamy, or you ate it somewhere else and you thought that place was really, really great. So then you went to a second place and it didn't measure up to your standard. So it's all relative. These types of observations are all relative. But because they're relative, they're rivalrous, which means as soon as one person knows something about creamy risotto, another person has to know something about truffle oil, and another person has to know something about, you know, it goes onwards from there, right? So the foodie in this sketch that you're giving, and I have observed it many times myself, is endlessly unsatisfied and can never be satiated because there's always a creamier risotto.
And so does that mean for the rest of us that the city has better food because of this so-called foodie culture?
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. Can you sit back and be a little bit unaffected by the hysteria and just go, yeah, but that's great risotto. I'm sorry you didn't like it, but it's pretty good. You know, I think there's something to that, you know, when... You know, if you can keep your head, there's all kinds of, you know, just great eating to be done at no cost of anxiety, right? And so, I think a very sensible approach. Go out and enjoy it. Just don't get caught up in it.
So I'm 32. I didn't really get into the food scene, if you will, following restaurant reviews in the paper until about, say, I don't know, when I could afford meals out, say, about 10, 15 years ago. But I have noticed since then that something has changed in the food culture here in Vancouver. I'm assuming the same has happened in other cities, say like in Seattle or Los Angeles along this coast. But what have you noticed has changed in Vancouver, certainly?
Well, I think it is broader. It's Western consumer cultures generally. But I will confine my comments to Vancouver, I guess, because I've most closely observed this scene here. But in the broadest possible terms, it seems to me that there were sort of three enshrined values in cuisine, in traditional cuisine before the foodie explosion, which sort of was in the mid-90s or so. And basically it was an adherence to continental, when you were talking fine dining, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was an adherence to continental preparations. It was a kind of muted elegance of continental flavors. And it was the worship of exotic ingredients, the best that the world could offer. So a sole was always from Dover, you know, and a crab was always Alaska king crab, et cetera, right? That's the way people thought back then. I'm going to eat the best. If I'm going to eat a crab, of course I want it to be an Alaskan king crab. I want it to be the best that I can get. And that, in the process of food becoming a massively active consumer realm, those values have been perfectly inverted. And so now what is enshrined there, you won't find a restaurant in Vancouver at the high end, at the, you know, who are really shooting for the foodie stars. You won't find a restaurant in Vancouver that doesn't enshrine the opposite of those three, which is to say, innovative techniques that break the mold of the restraints of classic continental cuisine, bold, innovative flavor combinations, surprising, and almost always big. Flavor is really big now. And the third one is not the exotic foreign ingredient, of course, but the exotic local ingredient. So those three values from 15 years ago have been completely turned on their head. That's a value-free statement. That's just what's happened. I'm not saying it's good or bad.
Yeah, and do you think that those three values that you've articulated just now, do you think those will be here to stay, or do you think we'll move, say, as... I mean, I tend to think that in other cities, those are sort of the way restaurants are run, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't see a lot of variants, to be honest. I mean, you go to a, England is, you know, used to be famous for its terrible food. Of course, that's, you know, decades behind us now. And if you go into a, I just happen to think of England because Warren Garrity, who was a, you know, star-studded chef here.
West, right?
At West, yeah. He moved to cook at the Bell, which is in Berkshires in England, which is a little place. And but I guarantee if you walked into his restaurant in the Berkshires there, they would talk about sourcing their pheasants locally, et cetera, et cetera. You know, using butter from a farm in Ireland or whatever. And so, you know, that all the same sorts of the same sorts of values would be expressed. I'm quite confident. But you were asking actually if I thought those would stay forever, and I'm quite confident they won't. I mean, if eventually, because innovation is what it is, it forces you to move on and change. I think what you'll find is that I'm not quite sure if pendulum is the right metaphor because it may swing to something completely different. It may not return to what it was 15 years ago, but you know things will migrate.
The other thing that I that you did in this book that I thought was quite nice was that you talk about the television chefs that we've been influenced by, affected by, whether it's Julia Child or Graham Kerr in another era, or even James Barber, who you lovingly remember in this book, the urban peasant who a lot of us grew up with the Food Network and outlets like that, that sort of affected how we've thought about food, hasn't it?
Oh, for sure. It probably does drive the phenomenon to some extent, but it also is a reflection, a real reflection. I mean, after all, television studios don't make their audiences. They sort of are called into being by their audiences, you know, so there is a demand for this, and so the Food Network has risen to meet that demand. And, you know, so they're kind of a reflection of ourselves. And one thing that that you can't out help but notice if you've watched food television for a while, and just the mentioning James Barber puts a perfect beginning point to it. Like, here you have James Barber, who sort of, there was a kind of a gentle, easygoing quality to, he was a guy who appeared satisfied with the dishes that he made, you know, and I remember watching him do stuff where he would put frozen peas in a dish, you know, I mean, so there was no, you know, there were clearly no pretension to it, and I remember his big thing was he would start, he didn't do any prep before the cameras started rolling, and I think he once promised a studio audience, I heard this, and I can't swear to his truthfulness, but it sounds right. Yeah. He said, I will order a pizza now, and if the pizza gets here before I'm finished this dish, you know, I'll retire or something. I can't remember what the downside was. But he did that, you know, because I'm just going to cook it now. I'm going to cook it fast. I'm going to cook it immediately without a lot of purposeful flair. And then you move forward to this sort of the crazy hysteria of your typical Food Network star now. And I mean, confession. I actually watched that show, Food Network Star, because I'm so fascinated by how they shape and craft these personalities, and that's everything they're going for, is like this kind of high energy, like absolutely sort of insatiable hunger that's got to emanate from this person in order to make them attractive Food Network person. So we have these personalities like, you know, like Zimmern and Paula Deen and people like that, and it's just over the top when you think that food expertise used to reside with people like James Barber and Julia Child. It's an incredible transition.
I've interviewed Graham Kerr before. I always wanted to interview James Barber, and I came close, but then because he had a book out, and then he died. But you met him.
I did, briefly.
Yeah, what was that like?
I was starstruck. Yeah. I met him at Feast of Fields, and it was one of the, that's a sort of hyper foodie event, but I got it to my own credit. I have to say I was very early on the Feast of Fields wave. Mm-hmm. So it was back in just early 2000. No, it was late 90s, I guess. And anyway, I knew his partner because I'd worked with her, and so we bumped into each other and we just chatted. And I remember digging for something to say because I was trying to impress my hero. And I remember saying, "Oh, you know, they have pine needle sorbet at the booth around the corner." And I mean, I had tried it and thought it was like ridiculous. It tasted like pine needles, which is not very tasty. Here I was digging for something to say, and I brought that up. And he looked at me like I was just out of my head. He said, pine needles. He said, I could have sworn you said pine needles. I was like, unfortunately, I did say pine needles. But so that was funny. Trying to impress James Barber was exactly the kind of thing that would not impress him.
What do you like when you go to a restaurant and you're there as a diner? I mean, do you have did you have a list of things that you're looking for or that you're expecting in the dining experience?
Well, you know, I've referred to this before, and it is really a very key thing for me. I just get If my pretension meter goes off, it's just a sign that I'm not going to have a good time. And when I say pretension, I don't mean snootiness or snobby waiters, because in fact, all that stuff, that old-fashioned pretension, is quite out now. You don't see that very much. People are customer service oriented now, and you know, all hail the neoliberal restaurant market, right? So I mean, you have to make money. It's a hard business, and so people, it's pretty rare you walk into a restaurant and like waiters look down their nose at you. I can't tell you last time that's happened to me. It's not very common. So what I'm talking about instead is when you get the feeling that the whole project is kind of constructed for an audience, you know? It's not anything, it's not you walking into somebody's restaurant and them saying, hey, you know, this is the way we eat. We like this. You know, we really love it. We hope you love it too. Here, have some of this. You know, instead, it's like we've built this theater for you and we have this kind of food on display and we really hope you like it. And, you know, and it's all sort of nervous presentation for the benefit of an audience. That's the kind of pretension I'm talking about, and you pick it up really quickly. And unfortunately, a lot of new food, I think, is like that. You know, it's really, really put on for the foodie with a kind of nervous and hopeful anticipation that, you know, that they'll be approved of. And that, you know, that to me just signals no fun.
And the food itself, I mean, your son asks you a great question near the end of the book about the best thing you've ever eaten. And that wasn't in Vancouver, when you're in this city, what's good food say? I mean, do you enjoy some of the fare that you say that you like some of the food at Farmer's Apprentice, but do you find? I mean, you can find good food anywhere and cheap, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, I you know, I've been asked this question a lot, and I sort of have a default answer, and it's not intended to be provocative or ironic at all. But when my family just says, oh gosh, I don't want to cook tonight, because I cook every day in my house, and I mean, I really like to cook, and that's just my fun at the end of the day. But if I'm lazy and I'm just like, oh, forget it, I don't, you know, let's just get some, we will go down the hill to Olympia Steak and Pizza. And I love it. I absolutely love it. And talk about pre-customer service. You know, this is a place that's just doing what they do, and they're doing pretty much the same thing they were doing 30 years ago. And they're not, it's the opposite of pretentious, right? It's like, this is just what we eat. We make this pizza this way, and we make this tzatziki this way, and it's just a Greek restaurant, you know, but it has a few spins that I really like, you know, and it ain't foodie food. And I wouldn't eat there every day, of course, but, you know, to me, that's like family night out, you know.
Yeah, and there's places like that in every neighborhood, aren't there?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, I would find the one in the neighborhood where I live. That just happens to be the closest to me.
Yeah. How do you cook? Are you one of these people that have recipes and measure things? You did some experimenting in the book where you weighed, you cooked to the milliliter. But do you cook without a recipe, say, and just wing it?
Yeah, I do, actually. At this point, I've been cooking for so long, I mean, I kind of know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I read recipes and then mostly just sort of jot down the order of things if I have, and then I put a piece of paper with masking tape on the cupboard above the stove, you know, so I can, if that's the extent of it, but I don't use measurements anymore. My cuisine is a really weird product of my father was kind of a nomad. He came from Toronto, would travel all the way around the world, lived in many, many places, and ended up meeting my mother in Ecuador, and my mother was in Ecuador because she was a Holocaust survivor, and her family emigrated to Ecuador after the war. She spent the latter part of the war in hiding, and so the refugee and the nomad met, and they lived for, well, I guess it was almost 20 years in South America, and had 5 kids, and I was the last one. And so we brought this cuisine back to Vancouver when we moved here, which was North European memories of my mother's childhood, you know, combined with like these South American dishes. It was sort of South American and Latin dishes. And when I went away to school, I took away recipe cards that my mother and I wrote down at the kitchen table. I remember, and this is when I went off to grad school, I thought I was going to do cooking. Of course, I ate pizza like everybody else, but I thought I was going to cook. Yeah. So I took away these recipe cards, and I have recipe cards for stroganoff, and then the next recipe card is ceviche, you know, and then the next recipe card is how to make rouladen, and then the next one is arroz con pollo, and so it's really funny. I still have those recipe cards in there. They're kind of like a keepsake of mine.
And you still make the stroganoff?
I do, actually. Yeah. I have two stroganoff recipes. One is like, was sort of holiday stroganoff. It was like he actually made it with strips of beef, and then the other was, you know, weekday stroganoff, and my mom made it with hamburger, and it's just, you know, by any conventional standards, it's just awful stuff. But I absolutely love it. And, yeah. You know, you ground beef and mushrooms and yogurt.
Tinned mushrooms, right?
Yeah. Well, if you can do it right. Yeah. If you can do it right, it's tinned mushrooms. But, I mean, you could probably cheat that and make it a little more contemporary. But, of course, I never do, right? Yeah. I just do it the old way.
Your dad was in the Philippines, I understand. Is that right?
He was.
Yeah, but did you live there, too? Or?
I did not. No, that was before. That was before marriage. That was sort of his first stop on the big world tour. He went Philippines. He worked in the jungle rebuilding a power station that had been destroyed during the Second World War. He had a pretty adventurous youth, that guy, I got to say.
I'm asking simply because my parents are Filipino, and okay. I read that in the notes, and I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, no, he had very fondly recollects Manila post-war and his time in the jungle. And he came back from his travels with a really exotic palate, which not a lot of people in West Vancouver in the 1960s could understand. So I remember as a kid, for example, he would bring home really, really hot peppers, which he would find somewhere, and then he'd pay us a nickel as we could eat them.
Has that adventurous palate obviously has transferred to you? Has it to your son?
Absolutely. He's a big eater, and the best thing about that for me is not to create a little connoisseur who's all opinionated and fussy. The opposite is true. I want to create, you know, it was my vision of a good eater is a very flexible eater. You know, you eat high, you eat low, you eat not very much, you eat a lot, you know what I mean? Like, just not be too demanding, but at the same time, very appreciative of everything.
In terms of burgers, and I ask this because you have a rule that you should never eat at McDonald's.
Yeah.
Yeah. When was the last time you had a McDonald's burger, though?
I got to say, it's years and years and years. I can't even remember. But I have had Egg McMuffins. That was the rule, never eat at McDonald's, is broken. I always told my son, only if you're going on a road trip, then you're allowed to stop and grab an Egg McMuffin, which is an undeniably good little sandwich. But, no, honestly, it's not a snobbery thing. I just don't have a taste for it, but I haven't eaten a McDonald's hamburger in eons.
But burgers have become, I mean, like, I had the burger at Hawksworth once.
Okay.
And they've become really just, I mean, they have become, I don't know if pretentious is the right word, but they have become sort of these constructed things that are just, I mean, you can't eat it like a hamburger. You have to eat it with a fork and a knife, and I find that troubling.
I had the Balloon Burger once at DB Bistro. I was on a foodie trip for a magazine article to Vegas, and so a friend and I ate it at Wynn's Casino. And yeah, it's just basically stupid. You know, it's like... It's like it's not really a burger experience. We make burgers at home, for sure. But it's supposed to be something you put a piece of cheese and some ketchup on, in my opinion.
You mentioned Daniel Boulud, that experiment, and maybe we recall that experiment, how that failed.
Yeah.
I read in the news yesterday, I guess it was, that Jamie Oliver is opening a restaurant here shortly.
Hey, that's news to me. I didn't know that. I kind of like Oliver, I got to say. I mean... Maybe that unpretentiousness is a kind of pretense in its own way when it comes to Oliver. I don't know. I haven't spent a lot of time watching him, but I have, on a couple of occasions, seen him throw together things on TV, and there is a kind of likable casualness to his cuisine, so I won't prejudge the place. But that's interesting. I'd be curious to see, you know, where and what that ends up being.
I'm a big fan of Canadian Club. And in the book you have a 70s I guess themed party. Well, that's not a themed party, but you take recipes from restaurants in Vancouver from the 70s and you make some of the stuff. And one of the dishes was prawns with Canadian Club sauce. Is that right?
Yeah, it was from a Quarry House menu. And God, I hope I'm not getting this wrong. The Quarry House, I believe, was in QE Park.
Yeah, that was the guy who played the trumpet, I remember. He owned that place, Frank something.
Oh, okay. That detail I didn't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, that dish, what the objective of that dinner was to find dishes that were common and yet really absent now. So something that you could put your finger on and you say, that was like in, you know, that was all the rage. People really, you know, dug that. And then ask yourself, well, why aren't people eating that anymore? So prawns with Canadian Club is really only a minor spin on shrimp with whiskey, which is like an old English preparation. So it's very typical for the era. You know, the preparations are essentially derived from continental preparations, so either French or English or German, right? And so this was an English preparation, and so they were doing their own little innovation by using Canadian whiskey instead of Scotch. And the only detail that we omitted in preparing that, I did this with a friend who's also a fantastic cook, and he and we didn't do the cheese broil at the end of it because it just struck me as too heavy.
Once you've cooked
the shrimp, it occurred to me you throw that thing under the broiler, you're going to turn it into rubber. So we, yeah. but the sauce, the Canadian club sauce is awesome. It's really good. You know, it's earthy and you put a little thyme in it. Oh, and you know, you thicken it with butter at the end. Nothing wrong with that. I'd do that again.
But you haven't made it since?
I don't think I have, actually. And part of the reason is we just don't have Canadian Club kicking around the house very often. But maybe I'll go buy some tonight.
Yeah. I know, as I mentioned in the introduction, this book is published by Nonvella.
Yeah.
For people that, they haven't seen the book yet, probably. It's about 60 pages, is it?
Something like that, yeah. 50-60.
And so... what was that experience like? Because this is a new concept, obviously. This is one of the first books that they've done, right?
It is. We're testing the waters. I think they're moving smartly into what could be a really interesting space, which is, online in places like sites like The All and Longreads, there's a real appetite. I don't know that there's a big business model for it, but there's a real appetite for long-form journalism, which can go, 7, 10, 12,000 words. So Nonvella is picking up on that and saying, let's try to distribute these things in ebook and print-on-demand form, and maybe just push them out a bit further so you're going just a little bit beyond the long-form journalistic piece as might run in a magazine, and you're pushing out into something that can really tackle a book-length idea but without sacrificing any momentum or any of the sort of immediacy of it. Because I think you can pretty much sit down and read this in one go or maybe two sittings.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, I'd certainly like to think there's a market for it. I think it's really driven by the ideas. It has to be an idea that somebody wants to chew through from beginning to end. But that's what they're going for, and I was, I had prepared some essays for Vancouver Review, which is now not in print anymore, but they still have an online presence, but they're not in print anymore. And Vancouver Review commissioned me to write some articles about food. So there was some material put together. I kind of had to just knit it into one hole and also, update it quite significantly because those VR articles were written 4 or 5 years ago. So that's how this project came to life.
And people can get it in the... Well, I have an actual printed copy, so I can buy that, say, at a bookstore or Amazon, certainly, right?
Amazon.
Yeah.
It's an Amazon distribution product. You go and buy it in ebook form, or as of today, I believe, which is the 26th of June... you can order a print-on-demand book.
I see. But most people will buy this, I guess, electronically and read this on a tablet or...
I'm not sure. I mean, I suspect that's the real target. It's $3.99. Yeah. It's a very affordable. It's a very good price point.
Yeah, and you're full-time at UBC, is that right?
I am now, yeah, as of July 1st last year.
Yeah, and so do you find that you have time to write?
Yeah, I mean, at a research university, the tenure-track faculty are expected to produce research, which in the case of creative writing profs is original writing. So it's a part of my job, basically. So I am what my business mix used to be, a lot of magazine work combined with fiction, and now I've scaled back on the magazine work and added teaching. So the writing is really undiminished. I've continued to produce articles, and there's this book has come out, and I'm working on a fiction, which I'm hoping to complete over the summer and the rest of the calendar year.
Yeah, and do you find that with the students that you have in your classes and sort of that you're reading good writing?
Oh yeah. I mean, there's the thing about the MFA program in particular is that it's hard to get into. So I mean, the students that are applying and getting selected are chosen from a group, and so with that in mind, we're getting some very high quality students.
Well, this book is such an enjoyable one. What you've done here, Timothy, is you've tapped into the zeitgeist in this town, certainly, and elsewhere about food, and you've written a really loving piece about it, and I mean, it's something that's all around us, I guess, and something that we don't really think about until we stop and read your book and realize just how maddening it can be, but also how enjoyable food can be. So, good luck with this.
Thanks very much. Great talking.
TimothyTaylor.ca is a website for more, and then, of course, Nonvella.com. You can find out how to get the book there, of course, Amazon. Foodville, Biting Dispatches from a Food-Obsessed City. It's published by Nonvella. It's author Timothy Taylor. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantum.